And she says of her husband, "My husband is a good man. He doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't swear, he doesn't gamble, he's never hit me, he's never robbed a bank, he's never killed anyone." And the friend says, "Yes, but what does he do?" "Oh, he sits on the couch all day watching TV. But he's a good man for all the bad things that he does not do." That's kind of illogical. I don't think anyone would go down that road, do you? And use such reasoning there. It just doesn't make sense. You cannot praise a man simply for what he doesn't do. By itself, that's just insufficient. And it is necessary that a person who claims to believe in God abstain from destructive, sinful behavior. It's true. But it's also true that that person is not righteous simply because he's abstained from sinful behavior. Many atheists and humanists might also abstain from what we call sinful behavior, but they're still atheists and humanists. So we're looking at then Christians. When we talk about sinful behavior, we often talk about it in the context of getting rid of it, the absence of it. And there's a problem with that logic by itself in that we might get stuck there. In other words, in our minds we might say, since I do not do this bad thing, therefore I find approval with God. God approves of me. But that fails to understand our objective and our work. In Ephesians 5 verse 8, for example, Paul calls us children of light. And I want you to think about that, children of light. Light is something that is added to a certain context. It is not the absence of something, but it's the addition of something. Light is not the absence of darkness. And if you think about it, this kind of gets kind of weird because it plays with your mind a little bit. The absence of darkness does not create light. Think about that. Light is something that is put into a situation, not simply the evacuation of all the darkness or the bad things there. My point here with this whole lesson is that we cannot be content with what some have called negative goodness, defining righteousness or good only by the absence of what is bad. In Matthew 5 and verse 16, Jesus says, "Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your not bad works." Well, he doesn't say that. He actually says, "so that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." He doesn't say, "so that they may see your omission of bad works." Although, in the process, of course, they're going to see the omission of your bad works. But what we're really concerned with is doing good works. We want to promote good works in the name of the Father. That's how you glorify your Father who is in heaven. You don't glorify him only because you abstain from certain things. You glorify him because of what you do as well. And that's what we want to focus on this morning. So we're trying to promote God to a sinful world, not only by omitting our sinful deeds, but also positively, actively engaging in deeds of light, acts of kindness and charity, godly virtues, all those good things. And I want to take this even a step further in your thinking here, that we cannot proclaim Christ and the gospel simply by not acting like sinners. We have to act like Christ. That's what gets people's attention. That's what inspires them. And that's what causes them to rethink what they're doing and to cause them to hopefully evaluate this gospel for what it is and come to their senses and you know, seek that salvation that we talk about so often. So the opposite of worldly or godless or self-serving behavior is not simply do nothing, not create a void. That's not what Christ would do. And all those who have named the name of Christ have accepted this responsibility to do something, not just do nothing. All right? I'm going to try my best to avoid the double negative thing here in this lesson, but I can't help it in some cases. So those of you who are grammatically proper, you're just going to have to bear up with that for this time, okay? Our world, as you know, is an increasingly sinful world. It seems like we're seeing sin not just more often, but just in greater intensity or greater profusion. It just seems to be not just everywhere, but also in so many different varieties. Maybe it's because we're becoming more aware of it. I don't know what it is. But people have come to expect bad behavior. That's just the sad truth in our society. We've just come to expect bad behavior. I know this because that's why we lock our doors. And that's why we alarm everything, like our cars and our homes and so on. That's why we shred important papers. That's why you buy virus protection for your computer. It's not because your computer is going to spontaneously erupt in, you know, worms and viruses and things like that. It's because someone else is going to do something bad to you if you don't. And you come to expect that. Sadly, you have come to expect bad things. So we're not terribly surprised when bad things happen, but we are very impressed, however, and moved by good things, which are not just the opposite of bad things, but they go in the completely opposite direction. They fill that void. They don't just create a void. They actually create a void first, but then fill it immediately there. And every time something particularly bad happens, like a bad tragedy, a shooting, a bombing, a terrorist attack, a tornado, an earthquake, something like this, we're shocked by the event itself, maybe because it doesn't happen that often. But what we're also shocked by in a positive way is the rushing in of good people, if you will, of good Samaritans, of helpful people. Well, the rushing in of those people, even to their own harm or to the threat of their own physical well-being. We're seeing that rescuing, that kindness that they're showing. Think, for example, of those firemen that in 9/11 rushed to the scene and went into those buildings. I think, my personal opinion is, they knew that this was not going to turn out well. And yet they went in anyway because they had a sense of duty that was beyond just sitting there and envisioning their self-protection. That's impressive to me, as I believe it is impressive to you. So the bombing was one thing that shocked us, what happened there. But what we're seeing here is the good men who rise to the call of duty there. We saw more recently in the Boston bombings there. A couple months ago, not only do you have the bomb, which surprised us all, but what was also surprising in a good way is you've got ordinary people rushing in and taking care of these victims in such a way that defies, you know, description. I don't think that you could have talked to these people ahead of time and said, if there's a bombing today, how are you going to respond to that? They probably would have said, I just don't know what I'll do. But then they did it. They rushed in and did this good thing. And you saw in the Oklahoma tornadoes that we've had here even more recently, where people have rushed in, again, really to their own peril in some cases, and trying to rescue and help and show kindness. This is what impresses us. Not just the tragedies and things like that, but what also impresses us are the positive, active scenes and depictions of kindness being shown. Such acts of heroism and extraordinary kindness are not the absence of something bad, but a positive action instead. Someone doesn't just stand back and say, oh, that guy's been hurt, but of course I would never hurt anyone, and then he walks his way, you know? Yeah, okay, so you wouldn't have hurt anybody, but will you help someone who is hurt? And of course, in the back of your mind throughout this whole lesson, you're supposed to be asking yourself, what would I do? How would I act? How do I act? Do I show positive acts of kindness? Or am I content to say, there's a lot of things I would not do? And would that justify you by itself? Among Christians, positive and godly acts of kindness ought to be what we strive to perform, not as something extraordinary, but really as an everyday behavior that befits those who are born of God and conform to Christ. We're not supposed to merely offer negative goodness, like, well, that's something I would never do, or I would not stoop to that behavior, and things like that. Instead, we're supposed to offer positive kindness, something that is actually done, not something that is merely avoided. In James chapter 2 and verse 15 and 16, for example, as part of our scripture, but I'd like to focus on verse 15 and 16 in particular here. He says, if a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, James says, what use is that? I want you to think about that in light of our lesson here. What James really describes, hypothetically, is a negative goodness person. Okay? It's not that I'm, you know, he's content in essence with saying, well, I wouldn't have done harm to this person. But James comes back and says, yeah, but are you doing good? And in fact, in this case, in this particular case, the guy is actually saying, I hope that all goes well with you. Good luck with that. I know you're hungry. Hope you find food. I'm on your side. I've got your back. You know, or something like that. All those other hollow, empty phrases that really mean nothing by themselves. You can't offer just words or ideas or a Hallmark card sentiment in the place of what is actually needed. If someone needs food to survive, you've got to give them food. And we cannot define godly behavior from what is missing from our lives, but only by actual deeds. As you see on the screen there, godly behavior is defined not by what is missing, but what is present. It is what is missing as well. I don't want to say that there isn't a realistic aspect to that, but it's not stopping there. It's going beyond that. In essence, we need to do the opposite. And I'm going to focus on the opposite thing for the rest of the lesson. We need to do the opposite of what wicked people do. But by the opposite here, we don't mean just the absence of wickedness. In Titus chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, for example, Paul says, the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men. Of course, he's referencing Christ himself there, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires. So you're creating a void, in a sense, by taking out of your life unrighteousness and worldly desires. Those are the things that have to go. But he doesn't stop there. He says, and now you need to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age. In other words, there's some things that have to get out of your life, but then there's some things that have to come in to fill the void. The negative goodness person is willing just to get the bad things out of their life, but not bring the good things in. And that's not sufficient by simply doing one thing without doing the other. So we're supposed to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, of course, but we've got to fill that void that's been created with righteous deeds and holy living. Can't just create a vacuum, you also have to fill it. Romans chapter 8, verse 12 and 13, there's another place, in essence, that teaches the same thing. So then, brethren, Paul says, we are under obligation, not to the flesh, in other words, not to live for your own human, carnal, self-serving will, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you must die. But if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the Spirit, you will live. Now, he doesn't address the whole part of this. If we link this up with, say, Galatians 5, 22 and 23, where Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit, all of this is going to come together. You've got to get rid of those deeds of the flesh. But in order to get to finish that picture, you've got to also bring in the fruit of the Spirit. That's what living by the Spirit means. Is that you're bringing in or producing that fruit of the Spirit. So, is it necessary to get rid of the deeds of the flesh? Absolutely. But is it also necessary, just as necessary, to also produce the fruit of the Spirit? You see what I'm getting at? It's just a common sense approach here to really address a philosophy almost that people kind of fall into. Perhaps unsuspectingly. They don't even realize they're there. But it's also something that is unbiblical, and we need to avoid that. All right, so we've been talking about concept. That's what we do in these lessons. We talk about concept, and then what we do is we talk about practical application. All right, you've taught me a lesson on an idea. What do I do with that? Well, we're going to contrast worldly behavior and then the new behavior in Christ. So we're going to talk about opposites here. The opposite of fear is not just merely living without fear. In other words, by God's standard, that's not the opposite. As he defines it, it is, in essence, living by faith. That is the opposite of fear, living by faith. When we live by faith in God, we no longer give life to our fears, our worries, our anxieties, and so on. Someone might say, I have no fear of danger, and I've met these people. I don't understand them, but I've met these people, okay, because I have lots of fears of, you know, tall things, you know, slimy things, tentacles, that sort of thing. And you probably do too. But there's some people out there that just seem fearless. Well, that's impressive, except that that doesn't make them godly people by itself. Just because you have no fear of something doesn't make you a God-fearing person. Doesn't make you a God godly person or a righteous person by itself. The lack of fear doesn't create automatically a man of God, is how we could look at that. Now, I contrast that with another man who says, oh, I live by faith in God. Well, then you ought not to be controlled by fear, right? You can't live by faith in God and still be controlled by fear. So there has to be the absence of fear in that respect, but there's also the positive thing that I live by faith in God. And we know that a perfect love and a living faith is what casts out fear, because we have faith in a God who is more powerful than whatever frightens us, whatever threatens us, whatever seeks to destroy us. And that kind of faith can't live in your head. It has to be demonstrated in your life. It has to come out in some visible manner that other people not only see, but are actively affected by. The opposite of unbelief is not mere belief. Like, you've got an intellectual thought in your head or an intellectual exercise of your mind, and therefore that's the opposite of unbelief. Rather, the opposite of unbelief is an active thing called obedience. Putting that belief that you have in your head into practice in conformity with the laws of God. Not just in conformity with what you think is right, but in conformity with what God says is right. That's important. Many think of John 3:16, for example, whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life, right? God so loved the world that he provided that. And so people really sometimes whittle that down to, I have a heartfelt conviction in my life about God, and that's sufficient by itself to be right with God. But that's not what he says. In fact, in the context there, not only of Jesus' words, but also the entire New Testament, when Jesus says to believe in me, he doesn't mean just have an intellectual idea in your head about me. What he really means is to obey me. Obedience is what he is after. Not just have a belief, but have a belief that's so strong that it demands action. That's what we call, really, conviction. A belief that's so strong that it has to be acted out. You can't just simply say, well, I don't have unbelief, therefore I'm pleasing to God. It just doesn't make sense. What pleases God is obedience, the active demonstration of what you do believe. The opposite of negativity is not mere attitude of positivism, but it is practicing whatever is good in God's sight. And I bring this particular point up because positivism has become very popular in churches today, in religion today, especially among TV evangelists and best-selling authors and so on. If you go to your Christian inspirational writing, I did on purpose, you'll see these books by these incredibly gifted, big smile authors who are all about, you know, thinking positive and thinking about good things and how positive thinking can change your life. It's true. Positive thinking can change your life, but it doesn't necessarily change your eternity. What do you think about that? You can be the biggest positive thinker in the world and still reject God. And you're still in the same place as where you were before, as far as God's concerned. So we're not after just merely positive thinking, but we're after what doing or practicing what is good in God's sight. And then we get back to that obedience thing. Being a positive person doesn't mean you're automatically a faithful Christian or immediately a faithful Christian or have favorable standing with God. Satanists, atheists, agnostics can be very positive people. And they're still Satanists, atheists, and agnostics. So don't confuse the two issues here, okay? Don't think that the opposite of negative, I'm not a negative person, and therefore that's good enough by itself. No, you have to actually do something. And that something that you do can't just be up here in your head. It's something you have to do. You have to act it out. You have to demonstrate that. Philippians chapter 4, verse 8 and 9, you're probably familiar with that passage. Paul says, whatever is true, whatever is lovely, whatever is excellent, of good repute, whatever is virtuous, and so on, dwell upon these things. And then he goes on to say in verse 9, the things you have learned and received, heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. And my understanding there is if you don't practice those things, then the God of peace will not be with you. So it's a positive thing. Paul puts it in a positive light. The opposite of jealousy is not indifference or having no feelings whatsoever, the absence of all feelings about someone or something. Rather, it is respect and self-control, and is particularly confidence in God. And that last one in particular is an attribute that only a faithful Christian can have and no one else. An unbeliever cannot have confidence in God because he has not yet submitted to or surrendered to the terms and conditions of God's covenant with him. God's offering a covenant and says, I'm giving you all these things here if you just agree to this and live as my servant thereafter. And that person has not yet subscribed to that. They might call themselves a good person, or they may even say, I'm not a bad person. But what God is really looking for is those who are putting their full confidence in him. And when you look at a jealous person, and we're talking about jealousy in a negative worldly context here, of course. When you're looking at a jealous person, you're seeing a person who is not confident in God and who lacks self-control and who doesn't respect the right things or the right people for the right reasons. You're really looking at a person who lacks self-confidence and is insecure. You're not looking at a stable person, you're looking at an unstable person. And so what we're looking at then in this lesson is the opposite of that is not just the lack of the negative thing itself, but rather the inclusion as well of the positive virtue, the positive aspect here. It's not enough to say, I'm not a jealous person. We need to know what you are and that you live accordingly. You can't merely avoid worldly behavior. You have to practice and embrace godly behavior as well. The opposite of criticizing and being judgmental is not being merely stone-faced and silent and biting your tongue or having gritted teeth and so on. The absence of saying nothing at all, right? If you can't say something nice and don't say nothing at all, right? That little saying you've probably heard as a kid. In other words, there has to be offering of something positive in its place. Offering of support, offering of encouragement, offering of solutions. Not just avoiding one thing, but also pursuing something in the other direction here as well. Anyone can be mean and hateful and judgmental. Maybe some of us have been that way in the past. We can relate. Anyone can do that. But we expect that kind of behavior, by the way, among sinners who are unconditioned by the gospel, who live for themselves, don't live for God, and so on. But Christians have to resist being judgmental and resist being criticizing, and at the same time, not just stopping that negative behavior, but also including a positive behavior. At the same time, they need to be offering words of grace, edification, and truth instead. Paul says in Colossians 4, verse 6, let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how to respond to each person. Let me ask you at this point, does that describe you? Would you say that, well, I'm not a judgmental, criticizing person, or would you say I'm a positive person because of my encouragement and offering of solutions instead of just, I mean, what does describe you? Is it just the absence of one thing, or is it the inclusion or the presence of something positive? The absence of being a thief is not the opposite, of being a thief is not the absence of stealing. Like so many people would say, well, I'm not a thief. Well, that's good. The opposite of thievery, then, is being a giver, and a generous one at that. In other words, it's not the mere cessation of something bad, but it's a lifestyle of doing something good in its place. Getting back to what we said, not just creating a hole or creating a void. Suppose a Christian says, well, I would never steal. But he is tight-fisted, he is stingy, he is ungenerous, and he is uncompassionate. Well, that's hardly better than a thief, is it? That's a lousy representation of Christ. So, someone might pat themselves on the back and say, well, I'm not a thief and I would never steal. Yes, but what do you do exactly? I mean, what is your positive virtue in place of that? Look at your own behavior. What kind of person are you? Do you judge yourself by what you do not do and think that God will find favor with that? Or do you understand that God finds favor with what you actually do in His name? And that, of course, has to be in conformity with his son. The opposite of lying is not just not lying, but rather saying what is true instead, even when it's unpopular, even when it's unwanted, even if necessary, it's unsolicited. Christians cannot merely be people who do not lie. We have to be people who proclaim what is true, to proclaim the truth and speak the truth. We have to therefore know what the truth is and not be afraid to say it. I think Roy was getting at that a little bit in the class, or Richard was, or someone was getting at that point here in the class. You know, in order to know what truth is, we have to, identify truth, or know what untruth is, we have to know what is true. We have to speak that truth. We have to be proclaimers of that. You can't just know what's true up here in your head. In other words, you have to demonstrate what's true in your life. The opposite of strife and selfish ambition is not merely sitting back and doing nothing. Rather, it is positive action. Instead of sowing seeds of discord and division, which so many people can do so easily, it is sowing seeds of love and peace, which is a far more difficult thing to do, but is exactly what God wants you to do in the Lord. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3 and 4 says there, Paul says in essence, don't just look out for your own personal interests, but also look out for the interests of others. In other words, don't just not sow seeds of discord, but in a positive sense, you want to look out for other people's interests and what can I do to help and how can I help you in particular and so on. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. So don't just abstain from ramrodding your own interests. You need to pay attention and put forward other people's interests instead. And that's a difficult thing, and it's an unnatural thing to the sinful world, to the unconverted world. It's an unnatural thing, but it is a Christian thing. And if you are a Christian here this morning, I'm asking you, is that what you do? Do you seek other people's interests ahead of your own? Or do you just simply say, well, I'm not going to divide and I'm not going to rock the boat? Well, that's great that you don't rock the boat, but what do you do exactly? We need both sides of that. The opposite of murder is not refusing to kill someone. If you think about it, rather it is enriching the lives of others rather than taking those lives for granted or siphoning off those people's lives for your own agenda. The first epistle of John, the apostle there defines murder as simply withholding love from those whom you are expected to show it to. And he defines that withholding love as having the attitude of Cain. Of course, the Cain he's referring to is the Cain from Cain and Abel in Genesis 4, where Cain was so mad at his brother that he went out and killed him. And he's basically saying that if you withhold love, you put yourself in the category of that man. So a person might say, well, I'm not a murderer. Well, that's good. I'm happy to hear that. But do you show love? Because that's what really separates you from the murderers. It's not just the absence of murder in your life. It's the positive demonstration or inclusion of godly love in your life. And that's what makes you different. Because if you're not actively and positively demonstrating unconditional love to others, then John puts you in the same lot with murderers, and Cain especially. The opposite of immorality and fornication is not simply refusing to engage in those acts. In other words, the mere absence of those things, but it's also the pursuit of sanctification and holiness. Now, you'll find the passage, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 3, Paul comes right out and says, abstain from fornication or immorality, depending on your translation. Okay, so I need to do that, and so do you. But it doesn't end there. In other words, we don't just create a void and abstain from something without filling it in with something honorable. We can go to Hebrews 12, verse 14, for example, where the writer there says, pursue peace with all men and the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. All right, so then I need to abstain from immorality, but at the same time I'm abstaining from that, I need to be pursuing something positive. I need to get this thing out of my life, but I also need to bring this other thing into my life. Like what Paul said earlier, okay? Deny worldliness and ungodliness, but pursue this instead. Not that, but this. There's that formula that we see over and over in the New Testament. You know, not that thing over there, but this thing instead. Stop doing that, but do this instead. The opposite of sin, then, is not simply doing nothing bad. That's really not the opposite of sin. But it's choosing to fill your life with something good. In Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10, Paul says that we are created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. In other words, we're not saved just to be saved. We're saved so that we might do something, so that we might become something, so that we might honor God in what we do and what we become. And therefore, having a positive effect, positive influence on other people because of what we've done. Remember all those people I showed you in the pictures earlier in the lesson that rushed to help? What if they had just stayed back in the crowd? What would you have thought of them then? You wouldn't have known who they were. You wouldn't have been impressed by them. Their influence would have been passivity, right? I mean, there wouldn't have been any influence there. In fact, maybe even a negative influence. Like, how come that guy's staying in the crowd not doing something? But the fact is, the fact that they rushed in and did something separates them. And so it is with you. You need to rush in, so to speak, and do something. And not just sit back in the crowd and say, well, I wouldn't have done bad things. Okay, I appreciate that. God appreciates that even more. But that's not sufficient by itself. What exactly do you do? It is impossible to live righteously and walk by faith by doing nothing. In fact, we actually have a passage, James chapter 4, verse 17. James says, to him who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. So here's a person who's doing nothing. And James says, and that's exactly the wrong thing to do nothing. All of these positive attributes and all these positive behaviors will have a profound effect on those with whom we come into contact in our own sphere of influence. And those people will not simply look at us then and say, well, that person, it's impressive. They don't do bad things. I don't think people are going to stand back and say that. But rather, they're going to be impressed with the good things we do. And again, I'm not saying pat yourself on the back when you do something, and I'm not saying that we should try to save ourselves by doing good works. That takes it out of the context in which we're talking here. But at the same time, look at this list in a different way. Which person is more emphatic as far as his faith is concerned to you? Or which person would you like to have as your neighbor? Or which person would you identify as belonging to God? If you're looking at the first list there, where a person who has no fear, has beliefs, however ambiguous they might be, is positive, is not jealous, does not criticize, does not steal, does not lie, does not promote strife, does not murder, does not fornicate. Okay, there's a lot of things he does not do. But if he knows the right thing to do and does not do that, well, then he's still a sinner. That is sin to God. Now, compare that with the other side. Here's a person who is also not doing those negative things. But he's filling his life with positive things instead. He lives by faith in God. He obeys God. He practices virtues. He respects. He encourages you. He offers solution. He edifies you. He generously gives to you, speaks the truth to you, pursues peace with you, enriches your life actively, pursues holiness in God, lives a life of good works. Which person will be justified by God? Again, not only by his works, but rather by his attitude and his faith in God. Which person do you think God looks with favor upon? And you know what it is. It's a person who's doing something. Not simply the person who's abstaining from certain things, but the person who is not only abstaining, but also doing something right instead. Like Jesus says, go and do the same. Right? Go and do the same. I want to stress again, we're not more saved because we do good deeds. None of us is saved by our own works. But at the same time, Those who truly believe that we are saved will show that gratitude for our salvation in our demonstration of good works, because that's what brings glory to our Father. That's what honors Him. And isn't that what you're supposed to do? All that to say this, that negative goodness is a myth. The sense of righteousness or justification that is based upon an illegitimate standard leads to a false conclusion. In other words, it just can't work that way. Our representation of God cannot simply be carried out by things that are going on in your head. You know Scripture, you can quote verses, you can accept certain beliefs in your heart. You have to take it to the next level. You have to act out in a visible, active, productive manner your service to God. That's what He's looking for. And I'm not here to say that you're not doing it. I'm simply saying that if you are a Christian, that's what He's looking for. And that service includes, yes, what we're doing together as a congregation this morning, but it's hardly limited to that. It necessarily demands that you live your faith in every context of your life. That's what Jesus talks about in Matthew 5:16, so that people can see your good works and because of those good works can glorify your Father who is in heaven. Isn't that what you want to do? Bring glory to your Father? As a Christian, I would think that you should have no other objective than that. So that we can go to Paul here in Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, where he says, "So then, while we have opportunity, let us not do bad things." No, what he says is, let us do good to all people, and especially to those of the household of the faith. In other words, especially the Christians. And I think the point is that if you can't treat Christians correctly, then you are not prepared to go out into the rest of the world and demonstrate Christ to others. It starts here, here in the family, so to speak. So he doesn't say, let us not do bad to all people, but rather demonstrate good works. In other words, not focus on what is missing, but what needs to be there instead. Is that what you're doing? Are you focusing on what needs to be there, or are you simply focusing on what's missing? Because you know, we're all going to stand before Christ someday. And even if you don't believe that, it's still going to happen. And even if you don't think that's going to happen to you personally, it's still going to happen to you personally. So when we stand before Christ, and I'm citing here 2 Corinthians 5:10, where Paul says we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, and he goes on to say, and we're going to be judged not according to just what you had in your head, but according to what you did, whether it was good or bad. You're going to be judged then based upon the outpouring of what was in your head. Okay, whether it was good or bad. You can't just have beliefs and say, well, I believed in you, and Jesus is going to say something to the effect of, but you didn't show it, compared to the person who says, not only did I believe in you, but I showed you my belief in my actions. And that's what's going to be pleasing to Him. So what about you? You justify yourself in what you do not do. Or do you understand that God justifies you based on your faith in Him? And that faith has to be an active, demonstrated thing. It has to be something that you do in His name. You cannot be obedient to God simply by abstaining from bad things. You have to do what He requires of you. It's a simple thought, really. It's not a really difficult thing to understand. But I think it takes a lifetime to master that, don't you think? And that's why we're here again, hearing this lesson. Because we're all struggling with perhaps mastering that very thing. Maybe this is even new to some of us. Okay. And some of us, it's like, okay, I've heard that before, but now I need to do that, you know, better than I've been doing. I don't know where you're at in your life this morning. That's not my job. My job is to tell you what God says in His Word, and then for you to accept that as the truth and to respond to that in the proper way. Your proper way to respond to God's truth always comes up to the same thing, and that is your obedience. That's what He's looking for. I hope you're ready to obey God this morning. If you need to do that in baptism, that would be something to do. If you're prepared to be a Christian, you need to be baptized into Christ. Or if you've been a Christian and you're just not living right, you need to take care of that while you still have time. Whatever you need to do, take care of that this morning. Come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song that Jeff has selected for us.